In Southern California. Welcome, everybody. Good evening. My name is Rob Starr, along with Mr. Chris Davies. Chris, how are you doing?
Great, guys. Thanks very much. Getting ready for the Christmas season. How are you doing, Rob? Everything set in stone now for you? You can just sit back and drink, eggnog?
I'm not a fan of eggnog, actually, but I'll take some Baileys. Those are pretty good.
Eggnog and Baileys and eggnog, then.
Yeah, I can try that, I guess. I know the neighborhood's getting decorated with all Christmas lights, and I'm sure it's that way by your house. And been a good week. And just to remind our listeners, we are all broadcasting remote from our radio station studios because of the COVID-19. So we're all spread across the United States at the moment. But please forgive us if we start stepping on each other because we can't look at each other and see who's going to talk first or what or anything else. But that's the way it works in show business. But we're glad that you're all here tonight. We have some great featured guests coming up, and they're going to be a follow-up to a report we did in an interview with our chairman and board and president, Rick Olson from the Toro Company. And we're going to take it down a notch to break it down to a division, and that's the one that Chris and I work for, is the Irrigation and Lighting Division. So we'll have those guests on after the half hour. But what we'd like to do now is bring in the wonderful purveyor of Maven's Notebook, Ms. Chris Austin, and she's going to come in and talk about some water news for us. So, Chris, welcome to the show, and good evening.
Hey, good evening. How are you all doing?
We all be good. I'm good. Chris, you good?
Good on my side.
Cool. Excellent. You know, there was a story I posted about the, counties in Arizona that could possibly be uninhabitable due to, excessive heat. So hopefully you don't live in one of those.
No, I don't. I live in a nice, safe, private community, and it's nice, and there's very low rates of, maybe three or four of COVID-19, but it's spread out between 3,800 people or families, so we're pretty safe here. We're not shut down like L.A. is shut down. They still have restaurants that are open, and you can go inside, outside, get your hair cut, go bowling, go play golf, and so far so good. So can't complain. And as long as everybody, all of us and our listeners, please stay healthy, wear your mask, and just be smart about it because you got one life and you don't want to do something ridiculous and get COVID-19. Even though the vaccine's coming, sometimes it works and maybe it might be too late, but you never know. So, Chris, I was reading your stuff today, your blog, and what hit me right off the bat, you had a story about aliens, and I thought it was space aliens, but as it turns out, it could be something that's pretty strange. For that, can you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, actually, there was a story about a scientist who was walking out on the beach at Point Reyes, which is which is right north of San Francisco. And they found this very weird-looking thing on the beach, and apparently there were a lot of them, and it was like a jellyfish, but it wasn't a jellyfish. And, so she picked this thing up, and, she really describes it very well. Let me look here. She says, so she says, as she was looking at this, the mystery creature reached out of the pod of this little jelly thing in her hand with a tiny little arm and an even more minuscule pincher at the end, not unlike a lobster claw, and four eyes looking back at her from a translucent bulbous head. So it just really looked like an alien. So she was very intrigued by this, and she went back. And apparently there's this parasite that is in the ocean that finds these jellyfish and kind of goes in the center and invades it, sort of hollows it out and repurposes that jellyfish's body to what it wants to do. And they drift all over the ocean, so they've actually shown up in all sorts of places. But it's actually, kind of common, more common than you might think. So very interesting story about weird things that, that you find in the ocean.
That's what people say when they see me coming out of the ocean. So, but I'll keep my day job. Stick with not saying jokes. But the article says some of them come from Ireland. And I was surprised that somebody would pick up something that looked like a jellyfish instead of thinking they might get stung by one.
Yeah, I was always taught you didn't want to touch those. Leave them alone. But, you know, scientists are inquisitive that way. So, you know, they tend to do things. You know,
I guess.
One of my early lessons in chemistry was do not smell the unknown liquid, at least not with a full-on inhalant. Because when we had to guess it and whiff it, I whiffed it and, you know, had tears rolling out my eyes. So, you know,
it's like they tell you when you go in the ocean, you see a shark coming at you, punch him in the nose. I would never do that because I'd never see my hand again.
Because I would never do that because I would be turned around and trying to get the hell out of there as fast as I could.
So, Chris, is that going to stop you from going in the ocean from here on forward?
Yeah. You know, I haven't really gone in the ocean in a long time, so I'm not really feeling that I'm at risk.
Gotcha. Well, I agree with that. I think in the past, too, I've also been accused of having a translucent, bulbous head. So, you know, that rang a bell.
And when Chris has an idea, it lights up. It's great. It's pretty awesome to see. But anyway, what's new in the water world?
Well, you know, what is there new in the water world? Is there anything ever new in the water world? And, well, you know, not really. You know, we still have ongoing litigation. And, you know, there's a tribe up north called the Hoopa Valley Tribe who is filing another lawsuit against a permanent contract that the Bureau of Reclamation has executed with Westlands that would take water from a river that they depend on and divert it, take it to, you know, the Central Valley. They, you know, the tribes have really filed an ongoing stream of litigation because the tribes have, on the Klamath River, they have, like, rights to fishing because that was what they were doing long before, you know, everybody else got here, like us, and developed it. And so it's sort of like all they have to do is to litigate, and litigate on endangered species issues because that's the most effective thing that they have. It's a really difficult situation up there. You know, I think one of the greatest challenges that we have as a state, as California, and really as any state in the West, is, you know, we're really going to have to figure out how to come to grips with dealing with tribal water rights. Because, you know, the truth is, the tribes were moved out to reservations and they were promised water, but the water that they were promised just hasn't ever got there. And, you know, there's a lot of issues here that we have with the tribes that have been, you know, kicked down the road for a century or more. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting things going on with tribal water rights. For one thing, they have executed an agreement to take out the Klamath Dam on the lower Klamath River, which is going to really reestablish a salmon run in that area. And the interesting thing about the Klamath Dams is that they're not really supplying water for municipalities or for farming. Those dams were primarily hydropower dams, primarily sending their power to Oregon on transmission lines that cross forested areas, and we all know that that now has become a risk for utilities. And they're not even that efficient kind of a hydropower dam. So there's a lot of reasons to take these out. The reasons why, it's my impression that the people who are opposed to taking these dams out have economic reasons why not. You know, the counties have depended on the funding that they got from having these hydropower dams on their, you know, in their jurisdiction. But the good thing about economic issues is that that can be solved. Okay, you can. There's a pile of money that you can that someone can put up that will solve that problem. There are a lot of other issues that really can't be solved in that way. So that's the good news. So they're getting those dams taken out, and that's reestablishing the salmon runs. And, you know, there's a lot of similar issues with tribes and fishing rights, and we have some of them in California. They're really very prevalent in Oregon and especially in Washington. So anyways, the tribes, they fight on.
But, you know, for all the time it's going on, and it gets kicked down, as you said, the road, why is it taking so long? Why isn't the government stepping in? I mean, to me, it should be a simple, here's the deal you made X years ago. It's now here. They haven't, one side hasn't delivered. I mean, to me, it feels like a slam dunk case.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that there have been issues in the Klamath Basin for decades, and they've been arguing about it. And so I believe it's about 10 years ago, they actually got everyone to the table, the tribes and the irrigators and the state agencies and the feds, and everybody was there, and they drafted an agreement to take out the dams and, you know, how they were going to do this. And they got all those parties to agree. The only thing that had to happen after that was Congress had to ratify it. And, I mean, I'm telling you, this was a hard-fought negotiation that people in the area had worked out to solve this long-standing problem. And when it got to Washington, Congress wouldn't ratify it. And I will tell you, it wasn't because everybody in the California delegation was arguing for it, but no, there were people in, you know, in the California delegation arguing against it, and it didn't pass. And so that just sort of threw everything back up into the air. And it sets a really bad precedent when local people come together to solve a problem and work out a deal that only has to be blessed by Congress, and it doesn't get blessed by Congress. You know, that's a problem, because I'm telling you, the Klamath Dams and working, that was a long negotiation, and it took years to come to that agreement. It's, you know, so the Congress didn't ratify it. That sent everyone back into their corners, and that was probably maybe 4 years ago that went down. So they have finally come to the spot where they have approval from FERC to tear down the dam, and they worked out the finances, and they worked out how they're going to do it, and they found a way to do this without having Congress's approval. But it's been a long, drawn-out process.
Well, I guess it'll still keep going on and on and on. I hear they're dredging up some pass at the Antioch Dunes.
Yeah, you know, interesting. There, you know, you never just really know how much change has gone on in your landscape if you weren't there to see it in the first place. And I would even say, even after it changes, it's hard to remember what it used to be before. But they used to have a lot of sand dunes over by Antioch. And, you know, dunes are an ecosystem just like a river is an ecosystem, and there were plants and there were insects and butterflies and things that lived in the dunes. But we're talking, you know, early 1900s, and people looked at that and said, hey, sand, and, you know, sand is a component to make cement. And so they mined all these dunes away to make the concrete and the hardscapes of the Bay Area, in part. Mm-hmm. And so there's been a move on to restore the dunes, but the problem is, where do you get the sand? So they've come up with this, well, I guess it's not that the people needed the dunes and they said, where shall we get the sand? It's more like the Army Corps said, we're going to dredge this channel. What will we do with all this stuff that we dredge up? And then they sort of came to this idea, hey, we'll put it over there at the sand dunes. And but, you know, this is part of what, you know, we have to do, you know, as because we have changed so much. So, you know, the dredge material becomes the dunes, and the dunes get restored, and that's kind of good for everything because, you know, there are some plants and animals that depend on those dunes. And there was a very intriguing picture, I thought, of the people in the 1900s sitting on the dunes.
Yeah. Well, isn't the Corps of Engineers, they're taking sand from the San Joaquin River, and they're making it so they can get more space for the cargo ships going through?
They're pulling it up and dredging the rivers because, you know, there's so much sediment that's coming down from the mountains, and it clogs up the channel. So, yes, they're dredging the river there and pulling it up. Not always a popular thing for a lot of people, but you know, sometimes it just needs to be done. And so, yes, that's where it's come from. And they, you know, it's interesting, they shoot this dredge material up there, and they let the water settle out, and what's left is the sand. And so that is in part how they are accomplishing this restoration.
Does any of that dredging contaminate more of the water? Because they're pulling up a bunch of stuff. Is that going to affect any wildlife and other things?
I didn't get that was a major concern. So.
Hope not. So I guess we'll find out. We'll find out in the near future, I suppose. Like everything else. So. Well, Chris, thanks for joining us today and giving us a little bit of update on what's going around. Sorry I started off with the alien thing, but that tickled my brain when I saw that. I thought it was some space invasion, and I was kind of open for that, but we'll see. I'm kind of strange into that stuff. So, but thanks. But anybody who wants to get the latest in water, just please go to www.davidsbuildbook.com. You can become a sponsor. You can become a subscriber. It's a great way to be really updated on a whole bunch of things about water, and Chris goes into that every single day. There's so many topics on science and litigation and things that are happening all over the state, and it's the best thing that best place to get water news for Chris and I. So, Chris, thank you very much. You stay safe from COVID. And just a reminder to you, we're going to be off for 2 weeks because of the holidays, and they'll be playing music, Christmas music through that. And so we'll talk to you in next year, I guess is the way to say it.
Okay. See y'all next year.
Have a great week, Chris.
You too.
All right, we're going to take a little break and for commercial, and we'll be back with some featured guests that we have. And stick around for more of the Water Zone.
Are you looking for a place to buy your landscape and gardening items? Come visit us at Site One Landscape Supply. We offer a large and quality selection of irrigation, landscape, and outdoor living products such as Toro's water-efficient precision nozzles. Site One Landscape Supply has over 30 locations right here in Southern California, and we are the largest national wholesale distributor of landscape supplies in the United States. Site One's knowledgeable and friendly staff is equipped to help you with all your landscape, irrigation, and outdoor living projects. Whether you're redoing your backyard into a drought-tolerant garden or creating a water-efficient landscape for your client, Site One has everything you need, including the latest in water-saving technologies, drought-tolerant plants for your yard, irrigation supplies, fertilizer and weed control products, landscape accessories, hardscape products, outdoor lighting, and much, much more. Visit SiteOne.com to find a store near you or stop by today. Site One, we are stronger together.
Did you know that an irrigation system that has a leak of just 1/32nd of an inch in diameter, that's the thickness of a dime, wastes 6,300 gallons of water per month or 75,000 gallons per year? Well, with more solvent cement experience than anyone on the planet, Weldon formulates their products not just to meet a standard, but to exceed it. Weldon products are designed to provide even greater safety margins, often able to make up for common mistakes or less than ideal installation conditions, reducing the chance for leaks and costly callbacks. Weldon's invention of solvent cement over 60 years ago revolutionized the piping industry. From day one, Weldon has led the industry with their broad range of high-performing solvent cements, primers, and cleaners, bringing unique solutions to professional contractors and homeowners. Along the way, Weldon has earned the loyalty of millions of professional contractors who trust their products and depend on their outstanding customer service, live technical hotline, troubleshooting services, and free training. And because they care about the environment, Weldon was the first manufacturer to develop and offer a complete line of low VOC cements. Their hottest formulation is Weldon 750 Hot Weld, a one-step, fast-setting blue PVC solvent cement specifically formulated for superior, long-term, trouble-free performance. So whether you're a professional contractor or just a backyard do-it-yourselfer, choose Weldon, the trusted global leader in solvent cements for leak-free plastic piping systems. To learn more about their complete line of products or technical training, visit the web at www.weldon.com or call their technical service hotline at 877-477-8327.
All right, so welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone. And Chris, you know, last week we had the president and CEO of the Toro Company, and from a 50,000-foot level, told us about what they're doing about sustainability. And as most people know, Toro is quite a large corporation. And Chris and I work for the Irrigation and Lighting Division. So we thought to carry on and transition from the corporate standpoint, we'd step down one notch to our division and see how we implement sustainability and what that means to us as a business. So we'd like to have two of our guests come on, and here we go. Our engineer is having a little problem getting it started here. Hello? Chris?
Yeah, I'm here, Rob. Just waiting for the mic to come on and get the interview going. It sounds like maybe somebody at the, you know, we can't wave at the engineer through the glass window anymore, can we?
Like, welcome to
the
industry.
No,
Mr.
no.
McPhee,
here we go.
General Manager of Toro's Irrigation and Lighting Division. Welcome, John.
Rob and Chris, thank you for having me on the show. You have built a fantastic following of listeners, and I appreciate having the opportunity to talk with you today.
Oh, thank you very much. And we'd also like to welcome Mr. Dan Winterton, who's the Director of Marketing for both the Irrigation and the Lighting Division. Welcome.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me on. It's good to finally talk to you guys again. I know it's been a little while since we've seen each other, but good to hear from you.
Great. Well, let's get right to it. As you know, we just did a session with our Chairman and President and CEO, Mr. Rick Olson, and he gave us a vision from the corporate thing, and we'd like to drill down now into the separate little divisions here on the different companies here that we have. So representing the irrigation and lighting, we'll start off with John with a question. So how are the Toro Company's sustainability goals executed at your business level?
Rob, your question has multiple pieces to it. Obviously, because we are in the water business, Toro Irrigation serves a vital role in the enterprise's sustainability efforts. Sustainability has always been part of the irrigation business's core objectives and is an ongoing concept embraced through our people, products, and processes. It's deeply rooted in our process to help our customers enrich the beauty, productivity, and sustainability of the land. Our goal is to make products that keep our green spaces healthy by using water as efficiently as possible. We continuously strive to produce industry-leading irrigation solutions that apply water more efficiently to crops, turf, and landscape. Also, we place strong importance on the investment in industry partnerships and community outreach activities to promote water conservation. Some of our most visible national involvement includes the EPA's WaterSense program, the Irrigation Association, and the Wyland Foundation. Finally, our people are heavily invested in our work to help sustain our natural resources. This radio show is a great example of how our employees, like Chris and yourself, promote responsible water use.
I appreciate that. So what steps has the irrigation business taken to ensure that they do what they say to accomplish their objectives, related to sustainability and water conservation?
To start, it's probably first a good kind of define how we actually define sustainability across the corporation. The definition for us has been separated into four strategic areas, which are human, social, economic, and environmental. Within the irrigation business specifically, we have established various objectives and goals for product design, performance, manufacturing, material sourcing, cost avoidance, operational efficiency, and product life expectancy. All of these goals are monitored on a daily basis to create continuous improvement and remain relevant in the marketplace as it relates to sustainability.
All right, so we have the next question for Dan. John mentioned a little bit about some of the collaborations we have. Dan, would you tell us a bit more about the industry partnerships and collaboration efforts that the Toro business supports as it relates to water conservation and sustainability?
Absolutely. John talked about a few of them, but we really, the big one we actively have been supporting for the last couple of decades has been the Irrigation Association. We really value the relationship and partnership and support that we mutually share around using water efficiently, so it's really been a good partnership. As part of our support with the IA every year at their annual trade show, which because of COVID this year will be going virtual, but we provide scholarships to college students that are wanting to start a career in irrigation through what's called the E3 Learner Program. This gives the students an opportunity to actually come to the show in person. They get to attend the education classes for the week that the IA puts on, but then they really get to spend some time walking the trade show floor, learning about all the new technologies and ways to use water more efficiently. And this last year, we sponsored over 30 students, and that continues to grow every year. So very proud of that sponsorship. We've also got a really great partnership with the Wyland Foundation. For those of you that are not fully familiar with Wyland, he's a famous American artist and conservationist, known for the Wailing Walls that he paints throughout the country. We're very honored to be able to have one of his walls right here in Southern California. If you've ever been down to the Long Beach Convention Center, you'll see that mural painted around that whole convention center, which is really neat. But every year he supports what's called the Mayor's Challenge, which goes out and challenges cities throughout the country to find ways to conserve more water. So we partner with that. We also work closely with the EPA WaterSense program to make sure that our products meet the expectations that are set forth by the EPA for water conservation. And we continue to do our part through them to promote water efficiency. And just this last year, we'll mark the fifth year in a row that we've been recognized by the EPA for our efforts to go out and teach folks about how to use water more efficiently. And then finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the partnership and sponsorship we have with this award-winning NBC news radio show that you two have been working on, The Water Zone. With the two of you and Mike Barron, you got to mention him, I have done for the past 5.5 years to inform and educate listeners about how to use water more efficiently, and the importance of saving water has been unbelievable. So I think it's, 15, 20 awards that you all have garnered over the last 5+ years on the air. That's just remarkable, and I want to thank you all for that.
Oh, thanks, and it's 17, so we're very blessed.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
All right, thank you, Dan. Hey, that's great. Appreciate you mentioning that. So every day when the work gets done out in the field and in the trenches, it's the products, right, Dan? So maybe we can talk just a little more specifically about some of the products that Toro has that conserve water and how they work.
Yeah, we've built quite a portfolio over the last several years, and it continues to really focus on making products that are out there to conserve water. We'll start with the smart controllers that we sell. This is really the brains of the operation that now can automatically adjust watering run times based on the weather to make sure people are only using the water that is needed for the plant material on that specific day. Next, we have a range of sensors available that can do everything from shutting off irrigation controllers when it's raining to measuring just how much moisture is actually in the soil, and then either allowing the controller to water or not allowing the controller to water based on what the ground says the moisture levels are. Then you move out to the actual sprinklers that you see in the ground. We have a series of sprinkler spray bodies that will regulate the pressure going through them, so they're eliminating the misting or the really fine water droplets that are getting blown away in the wind and not actually reaching its final destination, which is just wasting water. And then finally, the last piece I'd mention is really the nozzling that goes on top of the sprinkler. We have an award-winning nozzle that will save you up to 35% water versus regular spray nozzles without compromising the results and damaging your landscape. So the nozzle really goes on top of the sprinkler like you would do changing out a light bulb in your house. You screw out the old one, you screw in the new one, and then save a lot of water. And the reason being is the application of this nozzle is putting out water at a rate of 1 inch per hour, which really lets you better manage the water use, eliminate the water runoff, and reduce the water waste that goes down in the gutters, and then ultimately saves you money on your water bills. So, and then, you know, the last thing I would mention on this, Chris, is most all of these products are available for rebates through your water purveyors or water districts. So they're really more affordable than you think.
You know, Dan, one of the most common questions we get here on the water zone is, you know, if we want to save water, why wouldn't we just stop planting so much plants and turf and all of that? Why does that? Why don't we do something? Why do people continue to keep planting all this stuff?
That's interesting, Ron. It's a great question, and I'm sure it's one that many people go to the minute they hear the words, you know, drought or water waste. Right? The first thing they're thinking is, well, why do we have all this green space? But the fact is, healthy lawns and plants are extremely valuable, and they provide so many health benefits. You know, in addition, you know, to serving as kind of that home base, you know, at your home for that outdoor lifestyle that a lot more people are getting used to now that they're staying at home. But it creates a great surface for the adults, the kids, the pets to go out and play on and enjoy. And that's just really the aesthetic part of it. But there's so many social and environmental benefits of healthy and well-maintained lawns. In fact, healthy turf grass does more for the environment than most of the plants you see. So first off, I would say, you know, lawns absorb carbon dioxide from the air, and it gets replaced with oxygen. One 50 by 50 foot patch of turf grass will produce enough oxygen for a family of four. Grass transpires water into the air, which will reduce pollutants. Turf grass reduces erosion by allowing stormwater to soak into the soil and reduce that water runoff or waste. And then finally, there's that cooling effect, right, that the grass or the landscaping provides, you know, along with the trees and the shrubs to help cool the air. And it does that by absorbing, you know, solar radiation and through a process called evapotranspiration. So if you think about the average urban area or average city temperature on any given day with all the buildings and the streets that, you know, hold that heat in overnight, which is called the urban heating effect, you can look at like a sidewalk that's probably at 100 degrees, call it Fahrenheit, and the grass right next to it is going to be in the 70s. So, you know, just that alone should let people believe that there's so many benefits to having healthy turf and landscape and plants. You know, I'm not even mentioning the noise and the glare reduction that comes from, you know, gravel and concrete and steel and all that stuff that we see in the urban environments.
Well, going back to John, in your opinion, has the irrigation industry seen an increase in sales of water conservation products and other technology advancements in the past few years?
Rob, the simple answer is yes. As Dan has just outlined, there's so many benefits to the new technologies that they are being adopted. With water being an increasingly strained resource, government regulations are on the rise around the world. The cost of water continues to rise in many areas, which is driving demand as well. Irrigation system efficiency is a growing concern, and measures such as mandated system audits are on the rise as well. Performance standards by the EPA and other organizations are helping push for more efficient products to help drive water conservation. Innovation is improving the return on investment and the ease of operation, which is increasing adoption as well. There are many reasons to be optimistic, as Dan has outlined, about improved water efficiency in the irrigation industry. Today's private and public consumers want to enhance the value of their properties, relieve the demands on their time, and be good stewards of the environment, which is making modern irrigation systems more attractive to everyone going forward.
Hey, John, that's an excellent answer to that question. So let's take it a little farther, kind of give ourselves a forward-looking view. Tell us, in your words, what do you see as the future of landscapes?
Chris, I know you talk a lot about this on your show. You know, what is the future and where are things going?
Sure.
You know, landscapes will be designed to kind of help communities adapt to a changing world by bringing artful and sustainable parks and open spaces to communities worldwide. And that's the soft approach part of the answer. The other soft part of the answer is preserving the landscape's heritage. You know, what was intended for? And lastly, just providing sustainable sources of water for agriculture. As I mentioned earlier, we see more stringent regulations on natural resources. The future landscape architecture will demand we use our knowledge of living systems and nature-driven designs to reduce the use of natural resources while creating places of value and beauty for all of mankind. Each landscape may be managed as a mini watershed to achieve the highest level of sustainability. In doing so, technology will refine more data into actual actionable information for professional managers to make better decisions going forward.
So kind of following up on that, John, do you see a current shift in the green revolution to sustainable irrigation?
Absolutely, Chris. The combined effects of climate change and resource scarcity require that we all pay more attention to our landscape design, vegetation selection, and irrigation systems. Landscape companies will likely evolve to being more focused on data to pinpoint watering needs and increase efficiency. Irrigation is only a piece of the puzzle. Toro, for example, has introduced landscape management software to help professionals efficiently manage their business, often from their smartphone or tablet. Managers can track crews, job sites, billing, irrigation schedules, and inventory, all from a single software platform. This holistic approach will lead to more efficient business models for the environment and the organization.
Well, to follow up on that same theme, what do you consider the benefits of a sustainable landscape?
Yeah, Rob, when we think about sustainable landscape, you know, key benefits include landscapes that require less maintenance, is long-lasting, and is often healthier. In addition, sustainable landscapes require minimal use of fertilizers and pesticides. Sustainable landscapes typically see lower water use, reduced runoff, and less puddling. Products like smart controllers, high-efficiency nozzles, pressure-regulated spray bodies and valves, soil moistures, check valves, these are all common tools to support a healthy, sustainable landscape.
So, Dan, how would you define a sustainable landscape design?
Yeah, at Toro, we view a sustainable landscape design as one that maximizes the least amount of water and energy necessary, right? So as we've mentioned already, we have so many products available today that will follow the weather or measure the amount of moisture in the soil and then make watering decisions based on the needs of the landscapes without using any more water than is needed. In addition, a sustainable landscape design is one that reduces the amount of water that's wasted or runs off, right, due to oversaturation. So understanding that every plant material and every type of soil are going to require different amounts of water and use that water differently. So again, I say the goal is to understand the needs of your plant material, which we have products that will do that, and apply just the right amount of water necessary to keep it healthy without any waste. And so, you know, as I keep hammering on, there's just so many products available today that will help homeowners do that and be able to achieve those healthy landscapes without the additional water waste.
All right, Dan, so kind of keeping on that same train of thought and answering a question maybe for some of our listeners who are thinking about a sustainable landscape, what is the best type of sustainable landscape irrigation system kind of comprised of? What's it made of?
Yeah. So again, Chris, I want to kind of hit on a few of these products we talked about. So there's a saying in our industry that says you can't monitor what you can't measure. And so the best sustainable landscape irrigation system is going to be one that you're going to get measurements from, right? And so and when you get those measurements and you find out what's going on with your system, and then either letting the system automatically make adjustments or at least giving the user the ability to make the necessary adjustments on their own, this is what's going to give you a sustainable landscape irrigation system. So there's so many products available today, and as I mentioned up top, a lot of these are rebated through your water districts and water purveyors. So it just really is way more affordable today to get some of these products and then ultimately give you the best sustainable landscape irrigation system without wasting water.
All right, with a sustainable mindset still here on this question, are there other ways in which we can protect our clean water use and still be able to maintain our landscapes?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So rather than always relying on our clean water or what we call potable water supply for the outdoors, there's several options available. Some people are using catchment systems, such as like a rainwater harvesting or what's called gray water systems, where they can either store that rainwater or some of the household water from things like showers and sinks and then reuse that water out on their landscaping. So, you know, obviously things like rainwater harvesting is going to be much more prominent in areas that get plenty of rainfall every year and not necessarily out here in the Southwest. But there's plenty of other options. You know, there's things called reclaimed water or recycled water, which is just another way of saying a reuse of water. And a lot of times you'll see this in cities and municipalities where this is the process of converting that wastewater into water that can be used for other purposes. You'll see these a lot of times on like highway medians or even golf courses, some parks, you know, big areas that need to be irrigated and they don't necessarily need to be using clean water to do that. So there's plenty other options out there to help save our potable water but still maintain the healthy landscapes.
Well, going back to John here, just for the final wrap-up question here, do you believe that global innovations will help enhance sustainable landscapes and irrigation systems? And what could be the future of irrigation systems look like?
Yes, Rob, that's a great question. Certainly innovation will be a key part of our future as it always has been. You know, while we strive to make our water resources sustainable, existing water infrastructure is in need of capital investments to tackle issues associated with aging infrastructure. Emerging information technology concepts are being explored as possible solutions for monitoring, assessing, and intervening prior to an infrastructure system failure. That same kind of thinking can be applied to landscapes and irrigation systems. Data collection and analysis can lead to improved problem solving and monitoring, which will increase the level of control and reliability. Irrigation systems will better detect and diagnose problems before significant water is wasted. Opportunities for efficiencies will be identified without in-person on-site monitoring.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that certainly is going to be the future of the irrigation and what that's going to bring, more data analysis, more hooking things to the Internet of Things and sensors and all of those kind of things. That is clearly the future. Everybody wants, you know, you can't make an intelligent decision unless you have intelligent data, and I think that's going to be very prevalent in our industry. So, guys, I certainly, both on behalf of Chris and I, we certainly appreciate you guys coming on the show and giving us your perspective as we break down from the corporate level from Faro into the divisional on the irrigation side. And I hope our listeners got a good idea of what to expect in the future. So I'd like to thank both of you again for being our guests, and you're more than welcome to come back anytime you'd like.
I think we would love to come back. We really appreciate the opportunity to spend a little bit of time with you and to talk to everybody about water. It's one of the most important subjects in our lives.
I couldn't agree more with you. I'm sorry to interrupt, Rob. I couldn't agree more, but thank you guys very much for giving us the opportunity to talk about something that's very near and dear to our hearts here at Toro.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, gentlemen.
Well, I think that gave us a good, clear insight of how it breaks down from the corporate level to our division. Right, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely, Rob. You know that I enjoyed doing that interview. It was one of the serious interviews we've done internally with our group, and I think it shone through in what our listeners just heard.
Absolutely. So we got some important industry news that's happening around the country. You want to fill us in a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. You know, we have the auspicious advantage of being one of the lead sponsors of the Irrigation Association. As Dan said in his interview, our listeners just heard, one of the associations that we have and the Toro was most proud of is the one we have with the Irrigation Association. And so even though there were no, you know, there were no events this year, and the traditional Irrigation Association show and conference, or the IA show, generally called, that didn't happen this year. It doesn't mean that the Irrigation Association sat idle. You know that as well as I do, Rob. It's very prevalent in the marketplace. Most of the features and the events that take place during the IA show did happen this year, and they were virtual in a sense. Although, Rob, I think you'll agree with me, we kind of missed the once or twice or several times a year, for those of us who do a lot of trade shows, kind of miss getting together with our industry colleagues that we see at these trade shows. You know, you see them face-to-face, you get caught up and talk a little bit. You miss that as well, Rob, I bet.
Absolutely. It's good to stay in touch, and you know, because you strike up different conversations that you don't normally have, because you don't get to see a lot of the people that are there, and you get the questions, It's a great place to do. Same thing with the AWWA, the American Water Works Association, who's partners up with us. We miss that because we hear a lot of different reports and analysis that's been done by different groups and new technology that's being introduced in the market. And there's lots of stuff to learn.
Yeah, it really is a window to what's going on in the industry. Appreciate that from a standpoint of you know, being on the product side of the business myself, you know, seeing what everybody's doing out there. But it's just the catching up and seeing folks that, if you've been in the industry for a while, like you and I have, right?
Right.
People have gone different directions in different ways, and just the IA shows and trade shows in general are just a way to catch up with them. Not just industry folks, but you know, water conservation in general, all of the agencies. Government agencies and people that we've met in our associations over the years. Great to see them at those events. But I think what I'd like to do, Rob, if I can just take a couple of minutes here, and we've talked to the IA and told them we'd do this. Every year that they do the number of awards, people awards and product awards. So if I can take a couple of minutes, Rob, and just go over the People Awards, because there are three of them that the IA just announced. Actually, it's not a part of November last month, but they've announced the Innovator Award, Excellence in Education Award, and Vanguard Award. And so I'd just like to go over them, if that's okay with you.
Sure, go for it.
So, you know, the first one is the Innovator Award, and I am very happy for the award recipient here, Stephen Smith of Wade Water LLC. If you've been in the industry any amount of time, you've had the opportunity to come across Steve Smith, talk to him, read something he's published, you know, some way had an interaction. But Steve was was being recognized for his creation and development of the Irrigation Innovation Consortium. That's the Colorado State University, Fort Collins, Colorado. Congratulations to Steve on that. Anybody who wants to find out any more information can go to irrigationinnovation.org, all one string, find out a little bit more. You know, the consortium has been around for a while. It's not new, and it's great to see Stephen Smith get some recognition for that.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah, great guy. Right. The second of three awards is the Excellence in Education Award. This was given to Professor Isaiah Kaseka, and Isaiah is at the University of California, Davis. He was recognized for just being an outstanding educator and for his efforts in really reviving the irrigation curriculum at UC Davis, right? That I don't know that I know that it went stale or anything like that, but it got a major boost in the arm from Isaiah Kaseka. And I've had the opportunity to see him once speak at an event, and very well spoken person, and it was great to see him. So congratulations, Isaiah, for the Excellence in Education Award. The last award is called the Vanguard Award. Vanguard in terms of being ahead of the head of the pack and the forefront, and it was given to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. There, and by the way, I'll preface this, there's a lot of three-letter acronyms in this, for the ARS sensor-based DRI SCADA management project. So I'll go through it for you. So ARS just stands for Agricultural Resource Services. That's a division of the USDA. And the sensor-based DRI SCADA management project. So DRI means variable rate irrigation, and SCADA means supervisory control and data acquisition. So what they pretty much developed and provided was a decision support system, if you will, mapping system for projects and partners of theirs, so that they can manage soil and water better. So congratulations on the Vanguard Award to the USDA's, the U.S. Department of Agricultural Research Services Division.
Excellent.
Full award side. Yeah, go ahead, Ron.
No, I just said excellent choices this year.
Yep.
Well deserved and earned. So we're coming up to our news hour, not ours, but FCC News, which we have to relinquish our show to. And we appreciate being on FCC News every single week. So one thing Chris and I always want to tell our fans is, keep our planet blue.
And one more reminder, two shows our Christmas music, so enjoy that. We'll see you all back the first of the year with our show, first week of January.
You got it. Good night, everybody. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, and now 102.3 FM.
News. I'm Tim McGuire. A second vaccine is